Hi, friends. My name's Annette, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm nervous. I'm a member of the Stony Creek Group in Ontario, Canada, and it's just between Toronto and Niagara Falls. So I'm very happy to be here. I've been coming to the Tennessee meeting for about 2 years now, on the Tuesday and the Saturday night, and it's just been such a wonderful time during Zoom to come here and see people. And I have to say, Karen, I met her on here, we discovered just the other day that I've been going to this conference one day roundup in Pennsylvania for about 25 years, and so is Karen, and we've never met. And it's just, we're going to go together this year. it's just such a small world. Anyways, you know what? I'm just going to start. I just say whatever's on my mind, and that's how I speak. It says in the big book to just share in a general way what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. And I'll do that as honestly as possible. I grew up in Toronto, and I had some interesting parents. My dad liked to listen to Creedence Clearwater Revival and fight with the neighbors, and that's all he did every day. And my mom liked to do yoga and wear mini skirts, and she had like a beehive hairdo and drove a Mustang, and she was just this free-spirited kind of thing. And the two of them, I had the most interesting parents. And except when we took holidays when I was little, my dad had this passion for excitement, and I remember when we were 80, he took us to watch the riots and the fires in Detroit in 1968. And then after that, the following summer, I was 9, and he took us to Washington, D.C. to watch the National Guardsmen on the street imposing their strict curfew. And needless to say, it was frightened me half to death, but these were the kind of holidays we took. And then if anybody isn't from the Eastern Seaboard, the following year in 1969, Hurricane Camille was a hurricane, a Category 5 hurricane, and we camped in it in West Virginia, where there was all this flooding, and there were state troopers leading us through raging rivers, and I thought, oh my Lord, I remember we finally got to this, up this mountain and out of the water, and I thought we almost died, and my mom gave us all to settle us down. So like these were the sort of upbringing I had. And then finally, the last one, I think I was finally 9 or 10. My dad took us camping in Kentucky to this Holiday Hill campground, where it was home to North America's three deadliest snakes. And I'm just like, I spent the whole week standing on the picnic table, you know, like that. I was like, oh, my Lord. And then the next, you know, I was always a fearful kid. I was always looking over my shoulder. I always just thought every car that's going to come by is going to kidnap me. I don't think those holidays did me well. The following year, I'm 11. Somebody asked me, would I like to smoke some weed in the local park? And I was all over it. And, oh, my God, I didn't even know that I was looking for any kind of ease and comfort. You know, I know I had problem getting along with kids. There was one girl a couple of doors over that she was my friend forever. And even to this day, we probably talk a couple times a week, and we've been friends for 50 something years now. And she was crazy like me, but she didn't have alcoholism. I did. So I started drinking when I was very young. I was like 11. It made me feel so good. I was like a magic elixir. I was smoking cigarettes. I don't even remember my mom and dad being too upset about it. Honest to God, there's all these times in my teenage years, my parents would, I remember once my dad said, why are you doing this to us? Like coming home rip roaring drunk. And I said, good question, Dad. I don't even know why I'm doing it to myself. You know, I didn't know that alcoholism is different, and I pick up one drink and it sets off this mental obsession and this physical compulsion to just want more. I was always drinking one, thinking about the next one. Also going on in my drinking, I I didn't care about my family. I was just ism, I, self, and me. And I never gave any regard to how I might be upsetting the household with my family. And, you know, here's my family, you know, with this young alcoholic daughter. And I would just go about my way. And I started treating my family like strangers, and strangers like family. And no regards to how they felt. You know, my sister, we shared rooms, and I hated her, and she hated me. And it took me, oh God, years in the program to be friends with her again and be a sister, be sisters, you know. And she certainly was affected by having to share a room with me. Everything was a jackpot for me. I was running with people I probably shouldn't have been running with for a while. I thoroughly enjoyed it. But then, you know, I had sort of a conscience, and I knew that how I was living, what I was doing was not right. I got expelled from high school for being drunk and mouthy. And I know you find that hard to believe. I'm not proud of that. And any jobs I ever had, I got fired from for drinking. It's funny, you know, that 20 questions you get in the AA literature, one of them says, oh, did you ever lose time from work due to your drinking? And I said, I forgot I had a job. I went out on a weekend, and it was about Friday when I thought, oh, I got that job as a secretary over at the company. And I go in there creeping in on the Friday morning, thinking that maybe they didn't miss me being away. That's insane. And, you know, and I was typing envelopes, just putting envelopes in the typewriter for them. And that was challenging when you're shaking and drinking. And the lady called me in her office. She says, we haven't seen you here all week. And I said, I guess you're right. And she said, I have to fire you forthwith. And that means now. I had to ask. So, you know, I had another job at a hospital, and I ended up drinking with a patient on the floor and ending up in emergency, getting my stomach pumped out. And I was just a train wreck. My whole drinking was not pleasant. And I was selfish, self-centered, insecure, highly anxious, just never seemed to. I compared my insides with other people's outsides. I never added up. So, make a long story short, I'm going places now. I'm finding myself in the back of police cars. I'm finding myself in emergencies. I'm finding myself finally at one point. I'm making new friends now because I'd been in the psychiatric ward for 20 days. My parents didn't know what else to do with me. And so I went in there. And I got out, and I made a new friend there, a girl named Dusty. And I don't know what happened, but Dusty and I went out drinking again. You know, it didn't matter how often I got sick. The next day was a new slate, and never thought of any kind of jackpot that I ever got into. And it was just a train wreck, my whole drinking, and young and wild. And so Dusty, I guess I passed out, and Dusty put me in a shopping cart and took me over to the emergency. So that's how I ended up in an intensive care unit. At that point, I remember having a divine moment of truth and thinking and hearing or something like, Annette, if you don't do something about your drinking, if I don't do anything about my drinking, you're going to die. And I totally believe that. I had alcohol and drugs were a huge part of my story. And, you know, and if alcohol wasn't going to take me down, the lifestyle I was living would. And, you know, I think about that now the way I am today. And I'm thinking, who is that girl? You know, and it was me. And living a life that was just, I kept waking up from a drunk, and I got a tattoo, and and it went on. And I'm not proud of that, but that's what happened. So I got out of the intensive care unit and knew that, I don't say I knew, my higher power knew that something had to change with me. And I didn't really believe in, I had a problem with God and religion in my house. My mother was Jewish. My father was Catholic. And my Jewish grandmother would come every Sunday and hated my dad because he was Catholic. And just had this huge resentment in the house, my whole upbringing. And it's just the way it was. And my grandmother was an alcoholic and arrived every Sunday with a Mickey in her purse. And she always smelled like gin and violets or some, she had some cream sachet. She always seemed to bury herself in to hide the fact that she was hammered. So every Sunday was like that. So when I finally had a chance, I went into the Addiction Research Foundation. And I had to go to the detox. I weighed 83 pounds. I was a shaking mess. And I'd really fried myself in my brain. And I've actually had scans in my brain. I have these white spots that should not be there. But anyways, they're there. And I have to live with that today. And I went to the Addiction Research Foundation and never drank again. Just like that. It's like unbelievable. I for years, I couldn't put it down. My life was, I was on a downward spiral. I've experienced pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. You know, I heard that speaker last week talking about, or it was someone this past week talking about looking down on people. And when you yourself are on the ground. And I was all that and then some. So when I found out they were going to take me on a Thursday night to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, I'm like, oh my Lord, how embarrassing. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous with a bad attitude. And, sorry, I was clicking my pen all this time. I'm sorry. I came in with a bad attitude. I looked around. I was just 19 years old. And I reached the legal age to drink, and I was finished. I got my alcoholism out of the way early. But I thought, oh, my Lord, what am I doing here? It seemed to me like this was 1980. And it looked like it was all full of old men and some old women. And I'm 19, and I'm thinking, oh, my God, you do not belong here. And I heard nothing that night at the meeting, and I saw nothing that night at the meeting until I was just leaving, and this young guy came out of nowhere. He looked like Bob Seger, I thought. And he says, hey, will we see you here next week? And I said, oh, you bet. Talk about attraction rather than promotion. But, you know, I'm kind of glad he said that to me, though, because I remember hearing a speaker. He went to his first meeting. He was a guy from Minnesota, and he went to his first meeting and was in some industrial area, and he couldn't find the door where the AA meeting was. And he was going to get back in his car and he was saying to himself, well, I tried AA and I can't find it, so I'm not going back. And this young scruffy guy knocked on his window and said, hey, brother, are you going to the AA meeting? The door's around here. Follow me. And he says, and that night he says, I'm 28 years sober, and I never saw that young kid again who showed me the door. You know, and something like that happened to me at my first meeting. So it certainly, I believe it was just a divine intervention one more time. You know, I ended up getting out of the Addiction Research Foundation. I've been going to meetings. I'm hearing nothing. I'm seeing nothing. I showed up with a huge monkey on one back on my shoulder. Trying to talk myself into, listen, they're talking about not drinking forever. You're only 19. You're going to like not drink for 60 years. Like, this is crazy. You know, and that's all I kept thinking to myself. And then, you know, somebody said, why don't you just put it in a one day at a time increment, and how you know, could even decide that you don't have a problem after just spending 16 days in the detox and 28 days in the treatment program. You certainly belong here. And I remember when I got out and I went and lived in the halfway house for a while because my parents got divorced when I was in treatment. I don't blame them. And they both got a one bedroom apartment with neither of them had any room for me to come home. So, you know, I felt like when I got sober, I was so young and emotionally I was about 11. And I found myself having to live on my own when I got sober. So, you know, I didn't have it easy and I'm not looking for any kind of sympathy or anything, but man, I don't know where I got the strength to keep my chin up and put one foot in front of the other and go out there and live my new sober life no matter what. And I did do it. So, you know, I give myself kudos for that. And God arranged the time in the day for so many great things to happen in my life. And he gave me friends that just instilled this enthusiasm for being sober and Alcoholics Anonymous. And I heard early on that, you know, to get a sponsor and get active and join a group and pray. And, you know, back then they would tell you to get a job and all that good stuff. And I started doing that. You know, it was hard for me to find a job at 8 months sober. What do I put on my resume? Got fired for being drunk at my last two jobs. And I got kicked out of high school. You know, I had to just have some faith to start my life over again. And this lady in Al-Anon who I knew said, listen, I know a guy who's looking for somebody to type his envelopes over at his business. And maybe if you go over there, I told him to maybe give you a break. You know, and God bless the man because I went over there and he hired me and I worked for him for 5 years in my first 5 years of sobriety. And just an angel. Something happened when I was about 4 or 5 months sober. I remember it very clearly. I got thirsty one day and, I went into the local tavern on Yonge Street and had a Coca-Cola. And while I'm leaving the place, patting myself on the back, I look out and there on the sidewalk is the nurse from the Addiction Research Foundation. I thought at first, is he following me? But no, just God set up this moment that Charlie, he was a lovely man. He's not here anymore. He says, did you drink? I said, no, I just in for a Coke. And he said, tell me, young lady, if you just escaped from the lion's den, would you go back to get your hat? And then he proceeded to tell me to, he told me about being constantly vigilant about the way I think and the way I act, my moods and attitudes, and to stay away from slippery places and stay away from slippery people and to treasure my newfound sobriety. And, you know, that was way back when. And his words, you know, I hardly remember anything in my first year because I felt like I was a little fried. But I remember those words to me about the lion's den to this day, ever so clear. It's engraved in my mind. So, you know, I started, I got myself a sponsor. The first one wasn't so great. I know that now. She took me to dances. That was about it. But then I met this lady who was married to, long story short, doesn't matter. But she started taking me through the steps, you know, and she started talking about accepting the fact that I was powerless over alcohol. And, you know, and I definitely couldn't. I did have an unmanageable life, but what I really needed was to look for a new manager, and it wasn't me. And as far as, I'm not going to go through all the steps. I like to talk about the first three just right now, because I'm nervous, but, you know, and then it just came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore me to sanity. For me, okay, sanity was obvious, but for me, the word restore was sort of like, this is the way I like to explain it. For me, keep an open mind. I'm different. If you're like it was garbage night and you're going along the curb seeing what kind of stuff people are throwing out and you see like an old plastic lawn chair with one leg missing, you wouldn't even pick it up. You wouldn't even think about it. But you see a little table and it looks like it's solid wood. It's kind of scratched and could use a little love and use a little polish. and shine it up and give it a little care and give it, restore it back to its, you know, I that's how I feel God did for me. I have value and I have worth, and God took me and restored me because he saw that in me when I didn't even see that in myself. And so I, you know, God doesn't make junk. So for the second step was a powerful step for me. And as far as turning my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand him, you know, and as we understood him is in italics in the book. And so that means to me it's important. And having a higher power now, just I had a hopeless state of mind and body, the way I think and the way I act, keep my emotions and attitudes in check. And, you know, that helps me so much. You know, they say in the big book that we were mental defective or full flight from reality, and don't have to be anymore if I constantly work on myself. You know, and I'm not, when I came in, I was irritable and unreasonable and bad attitude and all that stuff. And, you know, I'm allowed to sort of be on an even keel today. Let me see what time it is. Okay. I just want to tell you a story. When I was first new, I went to a meeting at a women's meeting. I didn't even know if I was a woman or not when I came in. I was just like this wild child who just, I didn't even know if I belonged at a women's meeting. I'm not kidding you. So I meet these three ladies in the suits, you know, they look like Betty Ford. I swear they had pearls on and everything. And I'm just this young kid, and they take me for coffee at the Howard Johnson's Hotel. And I'm sitting there, and, you know, they're being ever so nice to me, but I'm like, I can't jive with these ladies. You know what I'm saying? And it was just me and my self-worth, right? And but the one lady, she's really nice to me, and I remember her well. And then I really never saw these women again. All through my sobriety, my mother was drinking, and it was a hard to see her drink. And she was getting into lots of jackpots, lots of broken bones, lots of a horrible life. And I tried so often to suggest to her to maybe, hey, Mom, why don't you come to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous? Or, and, you know, I know for a fact my mother was so proud of me that I got straight, but never wanted it for herself. And my mother died when I was 28 years sober of cirrhosis of the liver, and died a horrific death. And I was going to visit her. It was just the day before she died, actually. I didn't know that. And I'm going down the hall, and I just happen to, well, maybe just because I'm nosy, I look in this room in the, you know, you go down the hospital and sometimes you look into a room, look at other rooms, right? I look in this room and this lady goes, Annette? And I'm like, oh my Lord. And she says, it's Donna. Do you remember me? And it was one of those ladies 28 years ago that took me out for coffee. And what an angel. She's in the room across from my mom. And then all of a sudden, it just reminded me that I've been at this thing for 28 years now. This lady remembers me by my voice or my face. And after I left my mom that night, my mom died, and they called a code on her. And apparently Donna told me afterwards that she was out in the hallway praying for my mom, because they knew she was passing away. And I was just like, and she told me that, and I was just like, all I can say is wow, okay? And God has always seemed to provide everything in my life. Even like when I had to make amends and there'd be people like, I'll never see them again. How could I? And then all of a sudden, you know, I was told if you became, you know, you've often heard in meetings about people, and there out of the blue, there was this person that I thought I would never be able to make amends to. And there they were. Unbelievable. And it's sort of like, I believe if you become willing, God arranges the time and the day. And that's happened to me countless of times. So, you know, I don't know what else to say. I'm not a long-winded speaker. I just like to share my story in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm 42 years sober now. I can't even say that without not laughing, but it sure as hell impresses me that I stuck around this long, because it was not easy. But what a gift. What a gift. And yeah, I just like to keep it short. So I just, in closing, you know, there's a guy in my group always says, if you're new and if you're out there, bear with me. He says something like, if you find yourself out there and drinking, and maybe some family members aren't talking to you anymore, or you've been barred from your favorite drinking establishment, or you're lonely and you just feel like nobody wants you, we want you to know that AA's door is wide open, and we want you. Thank you.